Welcome back to the Gardening with Joe and Holly radio show. Thank you for being with us today. Do you have ants in your house? We had some in our bathroom. We don't have them anymore because we used the rescue bait trap, ant bait trap.
Right. So we actually have ants every spring. And so we always get them like mid-April, and sure enough, they came around. So they, and what happens is ants seek moisture sources to feed their colonies and food as well. And once they establish that food source, they lay pheromone trails for other ants to follow. And so what happens is that with the ant rescue ant bait stations, they will transport the bait back to the colony, killing ants at the source. So they look for sugars to feed their workers and protein to feed their queen and larva. Rescue ant baits use both protein and sugar for a faster, more complete colony kill. And unlike any other ant baits that leak and spill bait on your floor, rescue ant baits are spill-proof and mess-free. I noticed that they are very well contained when we set ours out. And they're child-resistant and safe to use around the home. Better bait, no mess. Rescue ant baits have it all. You can go to rescue.com. They're made in the USA. Again, that's rescue.com.
Holly, let's go to the hotline and bring in our guest for this week.
Kelly D. Norris is one of the leading horticulturists of his generation. He is an award-winning author and plantsman and has a new book out called New Naturalism. Welcome to the program, Kelly.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you for taking time out of your day to join not only Holly and us and educate us, but all of our listeners across the country.
Now, you have a passion for planting more natural plants. We have a lot of listeners who have small spaces and need to grow in pots or containers. Is there a way to grow in containers with more prairie or meadow style plants and have it looking pleasing and not out of place?
Oh, I certainly think so. I do a lot of, I do a fair amount of container gardening myself because I like to experiment with new plants in containers. It gives me a chance to learn about plants up close. And, you know, sometimes I think when we have, you know, larger, wilder spaces, sometimes it's like the inverse. The container becomes almost the structural, architectural moment. So sometimes I grow plants like yuccas and those sorts of things, you know, in containers and use them as a sort of counterpoint to other wilder natural kinds of plantings. But I think in short, you know, you can certainly have a lot of fun experimenting and learning about plants in a wilder way inside of containers.
Well, a lot of people are buying houses right now and will often get a bunch of perennial plants with that house. I know many people feel bad if they want to change things up with the plants or get rid of them and start fresh. Why should people change their landscape and do what they want to do? So what are some classic perennial plants that someone should consider keeping if they are able to purchase a home with them already there?
Well, it certainly depends on, you know, what part of the country, you know, you're in. I mean, the whole idea about new naturalism is really thinking about place and about plantings that really resonate with place. So certainly if people are coming into a new home and appreciating or maybe learning or studying what existing plantings they have, you know, certainly take a look at maybe things that are already doing well or things that might be native, that might be a part of the garden already. It's always sort of, I think, worth a study of what's already there and use that as a place to start from or to really just to keep going. You know, we don't always have to start new gardens or new plantings entirely from scratch. And so I think, you know, I know when I came to my home garden here, the home I bought about 4 years ago now, there were certainly some, you know, some attempts at gardening at various points by previous owners. And, you know, flowering right now is a great flowering quince up along the foundation, which is sort of it's kind of a wilder looking plant. It's certainly not native to the U.S., but it's certainly a great harbinger of spring and kind of wilder in character. And it fits this sort of overall aesthetic and mode of my garden quite well. So I'm actually, you know, quite pleased to have it as well, too. And there, you know, also happens to be things like Virginia bluebells, which are native, in fact, but are things that the previous owner, you know, sort of adopted into her garden as well. So I love, you know, sort of embracing those elements of the past or those remnants of gardens that might become part of a new effort under new management, as it were.
Right. And you know, like you said, you don't want to necessarily wipe the slate clean because, number one, some of the plants that may be in the landscape of the home you bought are quite pricey and maybe somewhat rare.
Well, certainly, you absolutely, it could be the case. You could certainly end up with all sorts of things. You know, it's like if you have some nice pieces to work with, it's something that gets you started, and you can always sort of change them later. But, you know, when you restart a garden entirely, it's a fairly disturbing activity from an ecological standpoint, and can certainly invite, weed pressures and all those other sorts of things. And so oftentimes, I encourage people to really just assess the garden as they have it and to start to think about how their planting choices, if it's a garden, for example, that they have inherited with a house or something that they've bought, their planting choices can come to just affect the trajectory of that planting in a new and perhaps positive and progressive fashion.
Okay. So your new book is New Naturalism. Can you tell us something about the book, interesting or notable, and why our listeners would enjoy checking it out?
Well, New Naturalism is a conversation between gardeners. I am certainly a wild-hearted gardener. I have been fascinated by plants both in wild places as well as by plants in gardens for really the balance of my whole life. And the book sort of brings those two strands together in some ways to help encourage gardeners to just think about how we might invite more life into our gardens and how we might ourselves even live in our gardens more. And I think gardeners today are keenly aware that our gardens are not separate from the world around us, that in fact that they're a little green square in this larger ecological quilt that lays across the landscape, and that every planting decision that we make, every new planting space that we create or that we commence is a stitch in that sort of fabric. And so I think it's a great time in gardening right now because we're celebrating sort of the more is more attitude, right? More plants and more insects and more birds and more life and all of those, the satisfaction and joys and rewards that we have from that. And so New Naturalism is a one stroke and a sort of practical and encouraging. And in another, certainly sort of lays on, ways in which you can approach this that are grounded in science and practice as well, too. So I think there's a lot of things in the book for a lot of different kinds of gardeners.
That's really great. So we are talking with Kelly D. Norris, one of the leading horticulturists of his generation. He's an award-winning author and plantsman and has a new book out called New Naturalism. So talking about your book, there are those gardeners who have a really tidy aesthetic to their landscape, and maybe they want to introduce some more natural, wild-looking plants, but they just don't quite know how. What are some great tips to perhaps mix that in?
Well, certainly, grasses, no matter where you live in the country, we all have a native grass palette that can be really valuable. And there are so many grasses, of course, that are celebrated for their ornamental characteristics. And so even just, adopting one or two or three of those where it's appropriate, or if you're, I have a shady spot, for example, where maybe carex or wood rushes or other native, grass-like plants can thrive, those things can really start to soften some of the other forms of plants that we may grow. And so I talk a lot in the book about combining different architectures of plants and kind of contrasting them and starting to sort of marry them together in a way where they play off of each other, as opposed to, simply just a collection of plants arranged as lollipops because we like the way they look. Like that we have to think about, how plants actually grow together and how they change over the course of the seasons, because that's what we can learn from a plant community in the wild. I mean, that's sort of what the sort of those wild and natural places are thinking about. So I would encourage people, if you're starting to think about this, I mean, you can pick a group of plants like grasses or sedges, which I sort of did by default there, but you can really just in a bigger way start to think about how plants relate to each other and how plants grow and change over the course of the season. Famously, many of the bulbs that we love in the spring, are really quite ephemeral. They come up now and they do their thing, and their foliage kind of goes through a period where maybe it doesn't look quite so nice, and then it recedes, into dormancy. And so one of the great things in thinking about the garden is almost like a choreographer is, how do you layer something in so that that retreating foliage doesn't become as much of the focal point of what you see as compared to what comes next? And so sort of thinking about those layers of the garden and how they evolve throughout the gardening season is one way to just sort of, as you look at your garden and start to assess some of that.
Definitely. So I know I love visiting botanical gardens, and I definitely think that there's many benefits to them. And then, you know, they encourage you oftentimes to become a member. What are the ways that people can get the most out of their botanical garden visit, especially with something that's local and they enjoy going to periodically throughout the year?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, that one of the things I think that we can all do today, or most of us can do with a smartphone in our pocket. I mean, we have incredible cameras right at our fingertips, and whether you are a good photographer or not, it doesn't matter. You have a visual device to be able to record change. And if you, whether it's in your home garden or your local botanical garden or public park, you know, if you have a chance to really be able to document and kind of chronicle the changes in plantings over the course of the season, I think you could be really surprised, and you can find a lot to learn from about how plants evolve and change, you know, in the course of a season. And it can be really, really satisfying to sort of learn from, you know, just those small little moments and really embrace change, even in something as relatively short as a single growing season. So the other thing I would say is, if you're visiting a local botanical garden or a public garden, broadly speaking, you know, talk to the staff and the volunteers. Ask good questions. Ask them about their experiences growing plants, because they're there every day, you know, in those garden spaces, cultivating them, making them happen. And so, you know, the more insight that you can collect as a gardener about plants and how they grow and how they interact and respond to the environment, those are huge insights.
Well, you have a book, a whole book about bearded irises, a guide to bearded irises. What are some great reasons for our listeners and Holly and myself to grow a bearded iris, and what and why should our listeners check that book out?
Well, you know, irises are an important part of my original flora as a gardener, and I think we all have those sort of plants that we liken to those seminal chapters in our gardening lives. And yes, many years ago, I wrote a book about bearded irises. I think bearded irises are maybe, as irises go, one of the more accessible and commonplace and familiar irises. And of course, there's thousands of different varieties in terms of colors and patterns. And so, you know, bearded irises are the queens of spring in that way. And so, you know, that book certainly, you know, kind of walks you through all things bearded irises, not only from their history and their colors and their patterns and how they kind of evolve, but as well as how to grow them and the different kinds and classes. There's six different classes of bearded irises out there that you can plant and really enjoy flowers from for, you know, really months in the growing season.
Fantastic. So how can our listeners find out more about you, your great books, all of your great information?
Well, you can check out kellydnorris.com. You can sign up for my newsletter. It's a great way to see, you know, just what I'm up to and sharing a few sort of insights and tips along the way, and always love to hear from folks about their questions and their curiosities as it relates to all things plants.
Well, Kelly, we greatly appreciate the time you've offered to Holly and myself and all of our listeners, and the information you've shared with us.
I appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
For more information, please visit thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com.